we can do, since we've been doing Buddhist cosmology for some time now, the long mandala will sort of give you a picture of Buddhist cosmology. So we'll recite the long mandala. Okay. It's on page 13. We won't go into the Tibetan because it's too long. And I want you to have some understanding of what you're saying. The first syllable, which is in Sanskrit, phrase, which is in Sanskrit, is supposed to be a blessing mantra. Okay. Om Bajra Bhumi Ahom. This is the adamantine golden ground. Om Bajra Rike Ahom. It is encircled by an outer fence of iron mountains. In the center is Sumeru, the king of mountains. In the east is the continent Videha. In the south, Jambudvipa. In the west, Godaniya. And in the north, Kuru. These are the pair of subcontinents sitting on either side of each continent, Deha and Videha, Chamara and Aparachamara, Shatta and Uttaramantrina, Kuvara and Kauvara. These are the unique assets, one of each of the continents. The jewel mountain, the wishing tree, the cow that fulfills all desires, and the crop that needs no cultivation. These are the eight articles of royalty, the precious jewel, the precious gem, the precious queen, the precious minister, the precious elephant, precious horse, the precious general, and the treasure-filled vessel. These are the eight offering goddesses, the actress, the garland-bearer, the songstress, the dancer, the flower-bearer, the incense-bearer, the lamp-bearer, and the perfume-bearer. These are the sun, the moon, the jeweled parasol, and the victory banner. Adding to this all the riches possessed by gods and men, in abundance and leaving no form excluded, I offer it to the glorious root and lineage gurus, who are most kind and holy, and to the great Losong Tuong Doje Chang's divine assemblage, together with their retinue. In your compassion, please accept it for the sake of all beings. Once you have accepted it, please bestow your blessings upon me. Ground. Well, we don't have to say that for us, what? This is so we can say Idam Guru Ratnaman Dalakam Niriyatayami. The last part is the if you recognize it's a short mandala. Okay. So we went into that so you can sort of have a picture in your mind of Buddhist cosmology, and when you're doing the mandala offering, you're offering the world. Okay. So that's the image of the world in ancient Buddhist time. Okay, now we can do the refuge.
Sangye Chodong Tsogye Chodnam La Chanchu Badu Dhani Kyapsu Chu Daigye Chanyan Gyebe Sognam Gye Jola Pencher Sangye Jubar Shu Sangye Chodan Zogye Chodnam La Chanchu Batu Dhani Kyabzu Chi Dagye Chanyan Gyebe Chodnam Ki Jola Pencher Sangye Jubar Shu.
Let's recite the last time in English. Okay. I go for refuge until enlightenment. to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Supreme Assemblage. By the merit of listening to the Dhamma, may I achieve Buddhahood for the sake of all beings. Okay. We're sort of almost done with Buddhist cosmology. We did do a little bit of the actual geography, all right? Geography would be the different, what we call them, the different planes? That's the term that we use, right? Planes. So that would be the geography, the different planes. So we have the desire, form, and formless. We are in the desire, and human beings, the continents and the subcontinents that are described in this long mandala referring to the places where human beings live. We are on the southern continent, which is called Jambudvipa. And exactly where is this southern continent? So far, no scholar has been able to say exactly, oh, this is the southern continent. But speculations seems to be that the earth is Jambudvipa. Some say India is Jambudvipa. But for now, it seems like the growing consensus is that the earth is Jambudvipa, is the southern continent. Okay. And now that you hear, because of the word continent, the way you understand the continent, how can the earth be it's a planet. And it's not that in Buddhism that there isn't a concept of planets. When they were describing these continents, it seemed like they were describing the earth, because they do say the sun and moon, and they consider the sun and moon to be somewhere out there, detached physically from what we call the continents. Supposedly, there is this vast area that holds water and land, and it seems to be the earth, right? Vast area that holds water and land, and it is divided into islands occupying the cardinal directions. And in the very center, there's this mountain, and that's the Sumeru. And the relative to Sumeru determines your status. On a lateral kind of a relativity. So those who are above are higher than those who are below, and those who are above that are higher in terms of birth status, so to speak. Okay. The other continents, the northern continent, Kuru, the eastern continent, the western continent, so far seem to exist completely in myth. Like there's some sort of this mythology of other continents that exists along with our continents, that so far we have not had one visitor from those continents. And no one, well, I heard that somebody actually, Warren mentioned that there's this Lama who, it seems like he was kidding his son, but it's a story that he gave his son, that he went to visit one of the other continents, and he actually brought something back. And that thing that he brought back is some is something that the son has inherited. And knowing, well, from a little bit that I know about Tibetans, and from the sound of the story, it seems like the father just made up a story and told the kid, oh, you know, none of your business where I got this, okay? You want to know where I got it? I got it from the northern continent, okay? Not that he's mentioned it in that kind of attitude, but and then because the father was this very high lama, I'm sure the he was also serving as the lama of this kid, and you're supposed to take every word that your lama says with seriousness. So he probably took, well, I'm saying it, interpreted that way, he probably took the joke to be, or it cannot be a joke. There is a lesson there. He must have really gone to that other continent. That's my skeptical kind of mind interpretation of the story. Or he could have gone to a place called Northern Continent and actually brought back, you know, a rock. Okay, and right now it's in the home of this lama. I don't know, Bhutan. I don't know where he lives. If he's in California, I mean, I really would like to go and see that rock to see what are his properties and what makes it so northernly continental. Okay. So, and each of the continents are supposed to have what do you call subcontinents. And they are explained here, deha, videha, taradaras, and so forth. And where it says each of these continents has its own assets. So the assets are supposed to be for what, for the continents, right? You have, it's according to so you have the jeweled mountain, the wishing tree, the cow that fulfills all desires, and crop that needs no cultivation. And just like in the how the continents are listed, starting from the east, so these attributes goes to each one of those in that order. Mm-hmm. So the jewel mountain is found in the eastern continent. The wishing tree is found in our continent. A tree that fulfills wishes. We should have an expedition so we can find that tree. Forget about the lottery, you know. Find that tree and you can make your wishes come true. The western continent has a cow that fulfills all desires.
So they have cows.
They have cows, yeah.
And humans.
No, all these continents have human beings on them.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. They have cows, and they have cows over there, but not just any kind of cows, a cow that fulfills all desires.
Well, at least one.
At least one. And the northern continent has crop that needs no cultivation. These are the special attributes of each one of those continents, and you can sort of imagine that Jambudvipa is really India. And then looking at its neighbors to the north and to the east and to the west, and knowing the neighbors to have those specific attributes, like you could say, you know, the best leather is found in, I don't know, where's the best leather found? In Italy. Okay, we just say it. Okay, Italy. So Italy would be like the attribute would be the leather that, I don't know, what's a great attribute for leather? Yeah, the soft, the land of the softest leather,
yeah.
Something like that. Okay, so that would be Italy. All right, so you can sort of see that the cow that fulfills all desires, you can sort of see it as. Remember, there was a time going back to ancient civilization where cows were considered to be almost like currency, right? So you can sort of see that. What's the cow again? The cow is where? In the west.
Greek assets.
Yeah, it's in the West, right? In the West. The cow is in the West. So you can sort of imagine into the West of India, they probably had people there who did a lot of work with cows. We had you know, great, what do you call that?
Herds
of cows. And okay, and the crop that needs no cultivation, they probably imagine there was a place where, you know, the land is so wonderful that, you know, you literally don't have to work the land, you know, everything grows there. So you can sort of imagine, if you want to imagine that this vision of our world to be corresponding to some vision that ancient Indians had, you can sort of imagine that maybe they just thought of things to be that way. Where do you find jewel? Jewel is probably found in the East. And I don't know what the wishing tree is in the South, what they would have attributed to that, but...
Could that be the Buddha tree?
Yeah.
The Buddha tree? Maybe. Yeah. Maybe some sort of fascination with trees in some culture in ancient India, that they considered that they were the home that owned this very special tree. That maybe there was a tree that used to make... There was a time they used to go make wishes on a certain kind of tree. And they thought it would come true because of the special quality of the tree. So all that I'm saying is just, there might be some actual happening, some actual observation as to why, I mean, why would they say that in the North that there is this continent where the human beings live to be 500 years old? When you can actually walk there to see if you know, ask him what's their diet, at least, you know, how do you get to live to be 500 years old? Why do they say that when it can be verified so easily? Okay. Because you can understand at that time there were no trains. by boat would take, you know, remember the story of Atisha traveling from India, I don't know exactly from where, from India, but going to Sri Lanka. How long did it take? It took months by boat to get to Sri Lanka.
Wasn't there also one where they were going to Indonesia?
Yeah, Indonesia, yeah. There was that one too. Indonesia. It was Indonesia Atisha went to. And it took months to get there. So you can just imagine there's this land that they were on, and they walk to a certain distance and they see water, they walk to another distance, they see water. Oh, this earth must be completely surrounded. There must be a lot of water with land plopped up in different places on the water. And if you travel a certain distance, you will find land. You will find land. So there must be, you know, other land in different places that they imagine to be where they can't. It's sort of very difficult to try to get there. And it could be that some people get lost out in sea and they think that, oh, they must have landed in one of those other continents, because since it took so long just to get to the subcontinent, it must take much longer to get to the other continents. And by the time you get there, you're so old, you can't. You're too old to return. If you try to return, you'll just be returning, your corpse will be returning.
Okay. Does he make any mention about, like, they say the South, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, are they thinking flat? Like, are they thinking of, like, the world being flat?
Yeah, they're thinking of the world being flat.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Another point for Bill said about it could be the Bodhi tree, but this picture of the world predates Bodhi tree, right?
Yeah.
So that the idea of the wish fulfillment jewel was probably before there was the Bodhi tree.
Oh, I mean, that species of tree.
Oh, that species of tree, but not the tree.
Not
that
the
Bodhi,
yeah. Yeah.
There, and that
yeah.
Was the
Yeah. I mean, the Buddha probably chose that tree because it had that myth about it.
Oh, yeah, that could be too, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Approximately when was this come up with? When do you know the time frame of like...
Oh, no. Stuff? No, we don't really have a time frame. I guess for us... we don't know exactly how much of this is purely Buddhist, how much of it is pre-Buddhism. But definitely the framework for it is pre-Buddhism. And you'll find hints of it in the Vedas.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah. But you will not find a definite, you know, picture of the world in just one place in the Vedas. But you will see mention here and there. Okay.
What are the Vedas?
That's the pre-Buddhist religion. Not really religion, but that's what the religion of Hinduism. That's their scripture. Yeah. And Buddhism, along with this is a very interesting thing, that in ancient times, people felt freer to think than we do. In India, at least in India, you had a very established tradition that and they had a scripture, the Vedas, and the Vedas were considered to be, you know, words of, like the words of divine words, and no one can question them, and to question them would be a sin. And you had people like the Buddha who completely said, as far as I know, a book is written by a guy. I didn't see any book fall from the sky. So somebody wrote that. Somebody or some people together got together and wrote that thing you're calling the Veda. And the same way when someone talks to me and say something, I feel and we all feel it's natural for us to question what they're saying. I feel it's natural for me to question what these books are saying. And if I don't agree with it, I'm not going to agree with it. If it doesn't make sense to me, I'm not going to force myself to accept it. And Buddha wasn't just the only one. There were other movements going around. Religion in India is really separated into two categories. Those who follow the Vedas, and they have the different branches. And those who don't follow the Vedas, that is, those who don't take the Vedas as authority, as a point to refer to. And those who don't follow the Vedas as authority, Buddhism, Jainism, there are some others also, who see the Vedas as, okay, that's somebody's idea, it's nice for them, but for me, it doesn't explain things to me, for me. And I don't have to, it's not some authority that I have to follow. If I don't follow, then I'm going to, you know, I'm destroying the fabric of existence, of reality, or something like that. Okay. But still, there you could say underlying understandings that are shared by all of them. Those who follow the Vedas and those who don't follow the Vedas. Okay. And there was this growing movement happening in India. That sort of caught on fire, so to speak, a movement about trying to explain reality, trying to explain, almost like what was that? Not the Renaissance kind of thing. More like the time of Plato, Socrates. You know, there was this thing going on through, actually not just in Greece and Rome, in Greece, but also happening in other parts of the world around that same time, where people were questioning established traditions, Yeah, Socrates going around making people crazy, asking people silly questions. You know, people are saying, oh, that's not virtuous, and Socrates asking, okay, what's virtue? You know, and driving people crazy with those kinds of questions to the point where they had him executed. So there was this movement going on the planet around the same time, 500, 600 BC, where people were questioning established traditions. And the Buddha in India and along with other people were doing the same thing. They were questioning tradition. And at the same time, you had those who were, fanatics? Not fanatics. Fundamentalist movements also. Okay. So in the same way you had people like Socrates and Plato, and then people who were following them who were questioning the gods and everything else. You had people who were fundamentally devoted to the gods and saw that anyone who questioned them were, you know, were undoing the fabric of society, undoing the fabric of existence even. But in India, you had Socrates being, you know, taken to court and executed. In India, it was just somebody has an idea, okay. Somebody has followers, okay. It wasn't considered to be like, there were debates going on, heated debates going on all sides. The winner of the debate would be the one whose ideas get propagated, and the one who lost the debate would have to take on the idea of the other one. Like if someone defeated the Buddha in a debate, there wouldn't be a Buddhism right now. Everyone who was following the Buddhism at that, the Buddha would follow whoever the person who defeated the Buddha. Okay. So they had, because of that, they had a great system of developing debate, and because of that, you need logic, you need reasoning. So there were systems of explaining what is reason, what is logic, what makes a good reason. So, and that filtered into Buddhism, that filtered into all the other traditions in India. And also here in ancient, you had the professional, what do you call them, the professional there was some sort of debate also happening in because Socrates is now Socrates and people like Socrates is questioning, so it's forcing people to think, to reason. So that sort of brought up a system in the West, developing a system of reasoning. Where what do you call that? They had this people who were professional at doing that, delivering lectures in public. Where they, what do you call those people? Oh, yes, that's the word. Yeah. So there were people who actually went to school to learn how to do that. And it was for political, a lot of it was for political reasons. How do you persuade people toward, because they had some sort of democracy going on. So you have to persuade others about your point of view. So there were people who actually went to learn to orate. So that developed a system of logic and reasoning. And that is something that sort of like permeated the entire Western culture, even though you had things put on top of it. Just like right now, even science in the West, some people who consider science to be like another religion, and just another opposing side to religion, and even those who look at science as an opposing side to prove their point, they would use science, right? What I'm saying is true because no, science says so. Okay, and you have now. That may sound like at least to a scientist, like to be like an oxymoron, where there are people using science to prove creationism. Christianism is scientific. You have this, you have this, take a look at this data, it proves creationism. So they're using science to badmouth science. Okay. So you can say, just like here in science is like the foundation that people put things on. So in India, so there were these commonly accepted ideas, and one of them was, this is the world. This is cosmology. These are the different kinds of beings that exist here. They have the different groups have different interpretations of those different groups. Those who follow the Vedas consider the gods, the devas, to be the finite beings. Those to be worshipped. Those to be aspired after, those who you wish to become, those who wish in whose presence you wish to be. So for them, that's a finite goal. And you had those outside of the Vedas who saw the true aim of spirituality, of religion, was those very fine immaterial states. So they would meditate and then achieve a sense of infinite consciousness, and they consider that to be, oh, that's the ultimate objective of the spiritual path. And the Buddha didn't say there was no such thing as Brahma. He didn't say there's no such thing as those or that state called infinite consciousness or infinite space. What is claimed in Buddhism is that the Buddha saw them, and then he was able to see there is something beyond them, and that's why the Buddha was able to make the conclusion that Brahma is not the ultimate. That was the Buddha was able to say, instead of infinite consciousness, is not the ultimate, because there's something beyond it. So the Buddhist cosmology. Just like, every cosmology is, whether it is Western Christian cosmology, or whether it is Buddhist cosmology, or whether it is Hindu cosmology, is divided into the pure and the impure. It is divided into the world where we are in trial, tribulation, and suffering, and then there's a world where there is freedom, that everybody's aspiring to. In the West, we have more of a dichotomy of ideas, where you have those who bicker as to exactly what is the state of that purity, exactly what is the state, what constitute the suffering, what constitute the purity, the freedom, what we call the worldly and then heaven. Definitely state. You have Catholicism that says there's a limbo, and then other Christians say there's no such thing, and some Christians say you don't go to heaven after you die. You stay in your body as it rots, and then they're waiting for that second coming of Christ, and when Christ comes again, he will wake up the dead, will reconstitute the bodies, and then the decision to go into heaven will be established. Okay, so there's still that fundamental idea, there's a heaven, and there's where we are, and the heaven is where we're going to go. How we get there, there's a disagreement among the different groups, right? So Buddhism also has, there's where we are, and that's where we want to go to. It's a world kind of it's a continuation of being that goes from here to there. What's interesting about Buddhism, that Buddhism includes the what the others call purity. It doesn't say, no, it doesn't only say, no, the your purity doesn't exist. It says your purity is part of the impurity. Okay. There's a what Buddhism is calling the purity exists only within Buddhism. Okay. The explanation of that is, you can say the spiritual goal of Buddhism is to reach nirvana, right? Or Buddhahood. So that's the final, that's the final goal, and that's the goal that there's nothing beyond it. As far as the those who follow the Vedas are concerned, the final goal is to be with the gods, to be with the Vedas, to be with the Devas. For them, there's nothing beyond them. There's nothing beyond the Devas. That's those who follow there are nothing beyond the Devas. And the Devas were born as they are, and they will continue to continue to be for as long as there is existence to be that way. And for them, the part of the trial and the suffering that you go to, the state that you have to get away from, includes reincarnation. So that idea is already there. So you reincarnate back and forth, back and forth. Okay. And until all of a sudden you are freed from that having to be reincarnated. So just like in Western, the general understanding of Western religion, there is God, there is heaven, and everybody's going to be have some sort of audience with God at the end. And everybody's going to be in the presence of God. So that's the end goal. So in the East, there is the acceptance that there is a freedom from having to be reincarnated. So it's not only the Buddhists who believe that there is a freedom from reincarnation. This idea already existed. And there's a pursuit, there's a search for this method that will lead to no longer having to be reincarnated. Those who follow the Vedas believe that the end of that cycle of reincarnation ends when you are with the gods. When you're with Brahma, when you're with Indra, when you're with those gods. Okay. And those who don't follow the Vedas, who see beyond, who are able to, in their experience something beyond, they're able to see something where the beyond the gods. That's the what we might call the formless realms. Okay. And they see that, oh, when you reach the formless realm, when you experience infinite states of consciousness, when you're having your experience of meditation and infinite sense of space, that's when you reach the end of the cycle of reincarnation. So you take those two systems together, and the Buddha went into the first one, that's according to Buddhism, went into the first one. He had a very, it is said that he had a very open-minded sort of approach to it. Like, I'm not going to say it is when you reach that state, it is the end, and I'm not going to say it is not. I'm going to see whether it is or not. So the Buddha, you could say, did whatever. So those who believe that Brahma is the end, so they have a method how to reach the state of how to reach Brahma. Okay, how to become one with Brahma. You probably have heard that. Okay. And when the Buddha practiced that and he achieved what they call having achieved one with Brahma, he saw that while in that state, is there something further than this? And he was able to see there are things existent, way of existing further than this. And that's what made the Buddha conclude, yes, the state, what you call in the Brahma exists, but for you to say that it is the final state, that's where you're wrong. It's like someone, goes to travels all the way to Florida, and say, oh, I found the end of the earth. It's Florida. Right? And that person then say, oh, no, beyond that is just ocean. Then bother to investigate the ocean to see if there were, if there's anything beyond that. But because from their perspective, they concluded there's no more land. Because all I see is water. So it's the same thing as those who think of the devas, Brahma and so forth, the form, what we're calling here the form realm, as this is the end. This is where when you reach moksha, when you reach freedom, this is when you reach liberation. And the term nirvana, it is a lot of the terms that you encounter in Buddhism, nirvana, shunyata, emptiness. They're not unique terms that the Buddha created. They came up with. These are terms that already existed, and then you sort of give them a Buddhist spin, so to speak. Okay, so you have now the Buddha having gone through the training, and then reached the end, and then just like reached Florida and decided to say, wait a minute, I wonder if there's more land if I go beyond this. And Buddha actually ended up in Cuba or something. So, and it would say, oh, there is something beyond Florida. So Florida is not the end of the earth. And then the Buddha kept asking the question wherever he reached. I wonder if there's land beyond Cuba. And then he was able to go travel the length of Cuba and then go beyond and found South America. I don't know. Okay. And he kept doing this, okay, until he reached a point where his investigation found, oh, okay, this is the thing, and I'm looking for something beyond it, I can find something beyond it. Okay, so he also investigated those who were not, the methods of those who were not following the Vedas also, those who imagine those very heightened meditative states to be freedom. Like you practice meditation, you still your mind, you control your mind to the point where you're able to experience very refined states of mind. If you're able to keep going into that state of mind and you die into that state of mind, you will reach moksha. You will reach freedom. You will reach freedom from the cycle of rebirth. And so the Buddha did those practices, reached that state, and while in that state, was able to investigate that state. And as he investigated that state, and he wanted to say, is there something further than this? And he found that there was something further than that. Okay. And when the Buddha finally arrived at what he calls nirvana, and he said, oh, this is the moksha that people are looking for. This is the freedom from the wheel of suffering that people were looking for. This is the freedom that they thought they reached when they reached Brahma. This is the freedom that they thought they reached when they reached those heightened meditative states. This is what they were looking for. This is the one that, having reached it, I cannot find anything beyond it. And the sense of satisfaction that you are able to experience in that state completely fulfill your expectation of the kind of satisfaction you were looking for. Okay, so that's the story of the importance or not importance. I'm looking for another word, the relevance, I would say, of having a Buddhist system. Okay, so it's not that nirvana was something that the Buddha created in his mind. It would be nice to have something called nirvana that everybody can get to. Let me create a philosophy or system that includes it. And this is one of the reasons why you read a lot that where the Buddha doesn't like philosophies, because he considers philosophies to be speculations about things. And Buddha refuses to call Buddhism a philosophy. Philosophy in a sense of, I wonder, If this is true, okay, since the tree grows, there must be, you know, and then out of your speculation, you come up with, that's reality right there. Okay, it's not something that you directly experienced, but just some thinking that you had. Okay, so the philosophy as to Brahma is the end goal is that somebody had an experience that was legitimate. And the Buddha never discounted the legitimacy of their experience. The Buddha discounted their conclusion about that experience. It's like somebody, a very crude example would be somebody taking LSD, for example. And then they have this wonderful trip. And then they draw a conclusion. To get to LSD is heaven. And you know, there were some religions that actually, LSD was their holy ghost. Okay. Yeah. And they consider that to be, so it's not that the experience that they had, it should be discounted. Of course they had this wonderful experience, but the conclusion that they're drawing about the conclusion, about the experience, that's where they are wrong. Okay. And so the Buddha, that's why you see all these things that are shared with so many different groups, so many different religions, so many different organizations within Buddhism, but there's a different slightly different interpretation of them. So the Buddhist cosmology now, you have, it includes what the Vedas say, it includes what those who don't follow the Vedas say, and it has a part of it that none of the others are talking about. Like, you have the pure Buddha lands, you have the cosmology. It is not only just the places where beings live, but also the beings, the type, kind of beings who live there. So it includes all those beings and all those places that the other people are talking about, and it also has its own types of beings, its own types of places that you will find only in Buddhism. Okay, like bodhisattvas, for example, are only within Buddhism. Not only within Buddhism, but only within specifically Mahayana Buddhism. Buddha lands, Buddha realms, Buddha heavens, those kinds of places that you hear about, they exist only within the cosmology of the Mahayana Buddhists. So it's sort of like, you can't really say that, this is what this one is calling that. Okay. From the way you see the history of how these things develop within Buddhism. Okay. It already includes so many things already, and it has something that the others don't have. Okay. Any questions so far?
Huh? Is there a debate beyond the Buddhas? If he's debated that this is the end, who debates that?
Well, so far,
so far
no one has debated in that light. There are those who have debated that, saying, no, the conclusion we reach here is correct, your conclusion is wrong. So it's sort of like a debate of taking back. So there hasn't been maybe there was somebody who proposed something like that, but the idea wasn't so popular, it didn't survive.
Yeah, actually, like, once you're in the Buddhahood, I was this is you know.
No, if a bunch of Buddhas got together, they would completely agree with each other.
That's what I think that's what Bo was saying. When they start to debate and say, well, listen, I'm a Buddha and I had this experience, and Buddhahood isn't the end. There's another plane above Buddhahood. I think it's what
Bo was saying.
Actually, that idea does not come from the East. There is somewhat of an idea like that. I don't know if any of you has come across it. That's theosophy. You ever heard of theosophy?
Yeah, Madame
Blavatsky, Annie Besant. No? So there was this...
I went to a few meetings years ago.
Years ago. So you know a little bit about theosophy.
Very little. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was this somewhat of a... I mean, it still exists. It's not like it's died out. There are still people who... There are theosophists who still living. It's a growing organization. So their idea was somewhat of what you're talking about. Now they included everything that's already here, just like Buddhism, and they say, oh, there's something beyond Buddhahood. For them, what they're proposing is that they take the idea of evolution, and they say evolution is infinite. Mm. It continues. So there are beings who are higher than Buddhas, that their evolution continues after Buddhahood. It doesn't stop. So that idea so far has only I've encountered only in the West, in Western, but in the East, they have different. They keep going back into no. My conclusion was correct. Your conclusion is not the final. Mine is the final. Any other questions? And also, Japanese Zen. Maybe not just Japanese Zen, but Chen Zen in general seem to allude some interpretation of it seem to allude to that idea, where they say enlightenment is ever growing, where they have this idea of the bhumis continuing, or this Buddha is on the 14th bhumi, that Buddha is on the 15th bhumi, that kind of stuff. So they have, I guess within Buddhism there is somewhat of an idea like that, but I don't quite fully understand it, what they mean by that the Buddha on the 15th, the Buddha on the 14th. The Buddha land is bigger than the other. I'm not sure what they mean.
How many beings they've helped?
Maybe something like that. I've helped 15 trillion billion worlds of beings. How many have you helped? I've just started. I only got 1 billion.
It's like black belts. Right? Once you get black belt, that's the highest you can go. But they're like first degree.
First degree, second degree. Yeah, along that line, I guess. And you can sort of understand the reason behind it, like. If a Buddha has been a Buddha, imagine the Buddha that became a Buddha 1 trillion years ago.
Yeah.
And then someone who became a Buddha just this morning. So you can sort of understand that, well, you can't really say that they are absolutely equal. One has been a Buddha for 1 trillion years, 1 trillion eons, and this one became a Buddha just this morning.
Well, doesn't the idea of once you reach Buddhahood sort of, all seeing?
Yeah, all
time,
yeah.
So,
I mean, what's beyond omniscience, right?
Yeah.
What's more to know beyond knowing everything? Well, I know everything and more.
And I got an index.
You have those?
It just makes me think of things like, well, if they say the universe is constantly expanding, why wouldn't everything?
Yeah. Well, that idea of a constantly expanding universe is already in the Vedas.
Mm-hmm.
And it's accepted all the different religions, philosophies that came out of India. Most of them accept that the universe is expanding. But the way they understand it is that it goes through cycles. It expands, reaches a certain point, and then it contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And expands again, contracts. It's like the universe breathes or something. Okay. So, and then what they consider to be... The idea of infinite is very interesting as far as Eastern thought is concerned. It's like you can have degrees of infinity. which doesn't seem to, we can't quite wrap our minds around that. Okay. So you can consider infinity to be whatever the limit is, in a sense, right? So it's like infinity is, or you can say it's a relative term also. So how, it's like, imagine parallel universes, right? And they all have, they're all infinite. And relative to each other, you can say, well, how far does your infinity reach? Okay. It's like when you, if there is such a thing, imagine the universe like a sphere, kind of, and then you start at an infinitesimal kind of dot, and you're trying to move around the point where you're able to come back. That would be like your infinity, so to speak. I mean, it to try to explain it in that way, it's that you have sort of like we move infinity out of it, which makes it doesn't make it infinity anymore. So you're not, you're not comparing infinities, but just you could just say it and say without necessarily understanding it. Oh, they have different infinities. Okay. And it sounds like I guess something you could say. I'm not a math person. Anyone a math person here? Can you sort of say that in math? Different infinities?
I don't know. I'm not a mathematician, but it seems like infinity sort of
like
means there's no end.
Mm. So it's almost like if the universe is expanding, it cannot be infinite. Right? Doesn't that make sense?
It
went beyond what it was before. If it went beyond what it was before, how could you say what it was before was infinite?
Unless it already was before.
It sounds political.
Oh yeah. So the last thing here about cosmology that we reach is the Mahayana cosmology is the idea of Buddha fields or Buddha heavens. And it is understood in that sense that different Buddha lands, different Buddha fields they're different from each other. Like Maitreya's Buddha land is different from Akshobhya's Buddha land. And you read in the sutras where they're even compared to each other in terms of population, in terms of size, where one Buddha land has more population than another Buddha land. One Buddha land has more surface, square miles than another Buddha land. And that comes into play into where the Bodhisattva makes personal vows. There's the vow that all the Buddhas, all the Bodhisattvas share in common, but they are the vows that are personal for each Bodhisattva. And along the path, they will say, by doing this deed, I dedicate it so that in my Buddha land, there will not be this. In my Buddha land, there will be this. In my Buddha land, it will stretch. If this much, in my Buddha land, there will be this kinds of people. In my Buddha land, there will not be these kinds of people. And that is the explanation given for why there are, well, sort of like bouncing on each other kind of explanation as to why there are different Buddha lands. So that would be a difference in. But remember, Buddha lands are not, they are somewhat finite, and at the same time not finite. You understand what I mean by that? It is, as far as the Buddha is concerned, the Buddha who dwells there, that's it. I mean, there's no more evolution for that Buddha to go through. That's finite for the Buddha. But the Bodhisattvas who dwell there, they're still training. They're still evolving. So, and that's in that sense. Okay. When you reach a Buddha land, if it's not your Buddha land, you're still evolving. If you reach a Buddha land, it's your own Buddha land in the sense that it comes from your own merit, from your own work, then that's your finite. But at the same time, it will be there for an extremely long time, but there is some sense of an idea that eventually there will be no more students. What's beyond that, I guess that would be like somewhat of an explanation, somewhat of a train of thought that will go into what is beyond Buddhahood. Not exactly the same thing, but imagine a time now every single sentient being is in a Buddha land. There are no more beings in anything less than a Buddha land.
Right. Meaning they themselves have become Buddhas, or
they're Bodhisattvas.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Imagine a time when every being is, there are no more beings in samsara. Okay. And they're all now, but they haven't fully reached Buddhahood yet. So everywhere where you go is a Buddha land. And what does that mean? It's a Buddha land? It means the president of the president is a fully enlightened Buddha. And you know it's a fully enlightened Buddha. Okay. And everyone there exists for one purpose only. Their gross national product is Buddhahood. Okay. So everyone there is working to reach full enlightenment. Okay, after some incalculable ages go by, now everyone is now a fully enlightened Buddha. So the purpose of the Buddha land, yeah. So what's beyond that? No one says anything about it. You know why? It's already beyond our comprehension what is a Buddha land. Yeah. To try to figure out what is beyond that is ridiculous. So if there is a state beyond Buddhahood, it is ridiculous to try to imagine it. Maybe there is. Maybe there isn't. But as far as where we are right now, it makes no sense whatsoever to try to understand, try to figure it out. Mm-hmm. Trying to establish whether it is true or not. Yeah.
At some point I remember you saying, there'll never come a time when you cease to exist.
Yeah.
Would you... it's a little bit unfair for you, like if you said it's incomprehensible, and then I'm asking you to talk about it. but would you hold to that even at the state when that last bodhisattva becomes a Buddha? Mm. Now everyone's Buddha.
Uh-huh.
Would you hold to that too? That even then that it would cease to exist.
They will continue to exist.
Yeah.
As Buddhas.
Buddhas.
Yeah.
And
exactly how they relax, I have no idea. When all the work is done, how the Buddhas relax, what the vacation will be like. Maybe they get bored and start the stuff all over again, I don't know. Well, let's pretend to be in samsara. Okay. Oh, there's nothing to do, there's no being to there's no being to rescue, I mean, come on. Why don't you pretend to be in samsara and I come in?
Maybe that's how it all begins.
Yeah, maybe.
But I think Buddha is supposed to be above becoming bored.
Become bored?
Above that. Beyond that.
Beyond that.
The potential to become bored.
That is only because we are looking at it from our perspective.
That's only because we're looking at it from our perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, to become bored, don't you have to be feeling like there has to be wanting some sense stimulation?
Yeah.
And having some sort of...
having the need to have a sense stimulation, something that only we can relate to.
Yeah, so isn't a Buddha having transcended that?
Yeah. So there's no need for him to... The Buddha cannot experience boredom.
Okay. All right. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. So then they wouldn't...
Yeah. They would never be bored.
Right. But you said that's only from our perspective that they transcended that.
No, it would be from our perspective to think that after a trillion eons when there's no more beings to rescue, they would be bored.
Right. All right. So that's the opposite. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. I find this... I think one benefit, if it was something Buddha himself said, that if someone had asked, once everyone becomes enlightened, then what? If not answering, I can understand why not, or even saying, okay, let's not go into that, or that's
mm-hmm.
beyond our comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
Because I find that line of thinking is demotivating for me.
Really?
When I think about, yeah, because... I don't know why. I think, okay, now everyone's enlightened. It seems something about it is quite demotivating.
You see, you're trying to imagine it. And the only way for you to imagine it, you have to use references that you already know.
Yeah.
It is something that you have not yet it is composed of elements or objects that you've never experienced, that you've never perceived.
Right.
How can you explain them? Other than you've never perceived them. That's the only way to explain it.
Right, right, right.
If there can be some sort of reference to something that you already experienced, you can sort of use it as a sort of like a metaphor. It is like that. It is like that, but it's not that. It's like you went to the tropics and then you tasted this tropical fruit, and you come back here and then you're trying to explain to someone who's never been there.
It's
like cantaloupe. Yeah, you say it's like cantaloupe, but it's only because you can make the person as a reference of cantaloupe. So you can sort of give the person an idea what it's like.
Yeah.
But if the person doesn't even have cantaloupe, and it's like cantaloupe, there's no way you can explain it to the person.
Right.
The only thing you can tell the person, go over there and you'll see it.
Right. Yeah. So, I think leaving it like that might be helpful to say that when you get there, you know, wait, hold off judgment until you get there, sort of thing. Or
yeah.
Say it's inexpressible until you... Because I find when I do try to do that,
mm-hmm.
I find it quite demotivating.
Yeah. It's not that its very nature is inexpressible nature.
Right.
Like, almost like saying, not even the Buddhas can express it to each other.
Right, it's just for us. It's beyond what we can do.
Yeah, because we don't have the vocabulary for it. We don't have any experience reference point? Yeah, something like that. have you? I guess you. I guess it's called soursop. Soursop. What's soursop? Never heard of it. Maybe we have different names for the same kind of thing. It's a fruit. It's green. It has little black little. Not cute. It's green, green like an avocado. It, no, it has a not that tough. It's kind of a almost like a kiwi kind of a feel to it,
fuzzy,
and it has little black not just spots of color, but you know, like little
Prairie
bumps, like bumps, little Prairie black bumps pumps. On it.
Yeah.
And then inside is I don't know what they call it, soursop. It's about this. No, it will fit inside your hand. No, breadfruit is much bigger. It's breadfruit is much bigger than it. And okay, and it inside of it is like custard. Yeah, and it has little black seeds. It's in the tropics, tropical fruit. You probably find it in Chinatown. You find all kinds of fruits in Chinatown.
I'm sure you can find it.
Yeah. See, I just gave you. I was able to explain something to you, but using references that you already have,
green.
The green, the shape. But if what I wanted to explain has none of those characteristics, something other than any of those characters, there's no way I can explain it to you.
And you can't find it in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Manhattan's not Buddha.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not like the thing is by its nature completely inexpressible. It's just, being able to express something is something that happens between two people who have a common vocabulary. Like there's have you ever heard a language called Sangsar? Sansar?
Sounds like samsara.
Well, it comes from the same language. Sansar is supposed to be a language that meditators in India use, and that only meditators can understand it. Because they're using references that only meditators experience. So that's what samsara is supposed to be. So those meditators, because they have common shared experiences, they can label those experiences for each other, and they could have a conversation about something that other people have no idea what they're talking about. Okay. So I can imagine two Buddhas talking about, you know, the state of Buddhahood to each other, you know, and perfectly describing it to each other, and just expressing it.
Right.
So it's not that the state is inexpressible. Being inexpressible means that you don't have the vocabulary for me to even try to explain it to you. Have you ever had any an emotion, and the only way to describe it is using words that have nothing to do with what you're describing? What you experienced? How does it feel like? It feels kind of bluish. Bluish. It's kind of a, you know, bluish, sweet, sour. Okay. And these are the only reference words that you can use for yourself to describe your experience. And if the person had the same experience, and they would say, oh, I see how why you use bluish, sweet, sour to express it. It sort of feels that way. Okay. And then those kinds of made-up terms get embellished, and they become their own language, where blue and reddish and those kind of just don't make sense anymore. I mean, just don't apply anymore. It becomes a completely different language because it has different things that it's labeling.
You mean like the words become taken on a dual meaning?
No, it's like in the embellishment of it, that it goes more refined, more refined. It's like there's a more refined aspect of that feeling.
The feeling of
the experience. There's a more
more and more into it.
More and more refined aspect of the experience that you have to go create new terms for.
Oh, and then you drop the blue and the sour.
Yeah.
And you make some new thing.
Yeah. It's okay. it's blue douche.
Right. Yeah. I had that at Patricia's birthday party.
Actually, I have a friend of mine. Up to this point, he's 55 years old, I think. 55, yeah. He's ever since he was a teenager, he would go, his own personal fun was to create terms. And Blue Dush is his latest creation.
Blue Dush?
Blue Dush.
Blue Dush.
Is that a spelling? He just made it up. Blue Dush. And you would now go, we have a conversation about, oh, that's Blue Dush. You have no idea what he's talking about. And isn't that how we sort of pick up language? Especially language when it comes to emotions. I mean, you can say, oh, chair, you can say cushion, you can say black, you can say red. And you say, oh, okay, that's red. That sound is referring to that. Okay, something about that. But when you say happy, sad, anguish, more very, very internal things. How do we point them out to our child and be able to let them label it?
My son's first word is happy.
Happy?
Yeah.
How did you do that?
I don't know. I can still say it's like happy. It just couldn't play it. Mm-hmm. That was his first word.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you can say, it's the same way you say, happy. Black cushion. So there's an emotion, and then there's a word that is used in reference to that emotion. So one day I'll be able to understand what Dudush is, because I'll be able to say, oh, that was the emotion I had the last time he said Dudush. This must be what he's referring to. Dudush, Dudush, referring to Dudush, and it could be completely not it. But now I Dudush as a I apply the label Dudush to something. All right. That's it for now. So I hope I sort of gave you the common starting point, so to speak, as far as the relevance of the Buddha, relevance of the Buddha's teaching. How is it relevant for you? It's like soursop. Okay. How is Buddhahood like soursop? If soursop has no relevance to you, what should I bother explaining to you? If Nirvana has no relevance to you, it's not something that you had no. Well, it has. There's nothing in your universe that has any aspiration for anything that the description of Nirvana can fit. What's the point of it being explained to you? What's the point of you studying about it, learning about it? So you see that there is a relevance. Ah, that's what I've been looking for. He's calling it Nirvana. Okay. What they are calling what I wanted, it seems like it's not what I want. Okay, like according to Buddhism, being one with Brahma is not what you want, because there's something beyond that, and you want some. We all want something beyond that. Maybe Nirvana is that thing that we all want. Okay, that's the relevance of it. Okay. All right. Now this time, short mala. It's going to be both Tibetan and English. That makes it already long. That's not it. Sashi Bergi. Sashi Bergi Chonshin Medo Tam Rira Lenshi Nyende Gembandi Sangye Mite Bhuwa Yi Rok Nam Tha Shin La Chubara Shuk Here is a ground anointed with incense and flowers strewn, with its Mount Meru adorned by four continents, sun and moon. Visualized as a Buddha field, I offer it to the merit field. May all beings partake of a supremely pure Buddha field. Itam Guru Ratnamantala Kam Neyatayame. Gyawadhi Kyokun Sunam Yeshe Tsogzokshin Sunam Yeshe Lechungwe Dhamba Gunye Toba Sho. By this virtue, may all beings perfect the accumulations of merit and wisdom and achieve the two holy bodies that arise from merit and wisdom.